And I have to begin by asking, did you know when you asked your mother why you couldn't push the peas onto your fork with your knife that you'd asked a profound question?
I did not know it at the time, but that was one of many surprising discoveries that I made when I examined the history of violence, among them the theory that one of the reasons that violence declined between the Middle Ages and the present is that people restrained their impulses, showed more self-control, and among those manifestations was table manners, particularly knife taboos.
Clearly these are threatening things, and you explained to me the reason why knives that we get at our services have all rounded edges and can't cut a thing.
The phenomenon that this theory was meant to explain was why the homicide rate declined by about a factor of 50 between the, say, the year 1200 and the present. So a current Englishman has about 1/50th the chance of being murdered as his medieval ancestor. Goes against the stereotype of the carefree Middle Ages, people dancing around maypoles and all of that.
Three jolly coachmen, that's
I'll forget that. Yeah, they were... The problem was that the slightest insult and someone would stab someone else over the dinner table. For one thing, they all carried knives in their belts. The way that you would eat was there'd be a big carcass on the table. You'd carve out a chunk with your knife, stab it with a tip, put it in your mouth, and that was the way that people ate. Well, for one thing, it makes it easy for disputes to escalate in that case. And even when they started to calm down, just the image of the kind of point of a knife aimed at a face was a little bit too touchy, and so a set of knife taboos, such as never point with a knife, never hand someone a knife, arose, and one of them was don't use a knife for any purpose other than cutting, and including pushing peas onto your fork, which indeed I was taught was bad manners.
Bad manners.
Now I know why.
A lot more efficient, but bad manners. In any case, it is the manners of the court that begin to filter down through medieval society that begin to affect first the upper classes who have to appear at court to ask the favors of the monarch, and then, of course, the middle classes who are emerging at the same time ape the manners of the upper classes, and thus on down the ladder.
Yes, these manners, this self-restraint, self-control, dignity, trickle down from the court. We have a word for it, courtly manners or courtesy. It's not a coincidence that that the word court is in courtesy. And it trickled down. We now think of violence as something that is done to a large extent by poor people in the not-so-nice parts of town. But it used to be the aristocrats who committed the lion's share of the violence. If you remember the opening scene of Romeo and Juliet, two aristocratic families basically have a kind of a gang fight in the streets and bodies are end up on the ground. But the aristocrats stopped a lot of their dueling, their conflicts to defend their honor, and from there it trickled down to the middle class.
You describe it as the transition from a society based on honor to one based on dignity.
That's right. We think of honor as an exalted value, but what honor means in most times and places is that to be a man, you've got to defend your reputation with violence. If someone offends you, threatens you, insults you, then you lose standing unless you are prepared to react violently. That's still true in many parts of the world. It's still more true in the American South than the American North, where there are stand-your-ground laws and a variety of manifestations of a culture of honor. But it's the decline of the culture of honor in Northern Europe, Western Europe, the northern United States, that was in part responsible for the decline of one-on-one violence. And that's just one form of violence that I discuss in the book.
You introduce us in the process of this book to several thinkers who I must confess I had never heard of before. One of them, Norbert Elias. You just told me the pronunciation a minute ago. I'm not going to pretend I knew it beforehand. But a man who came up with an explanation as to why all of this happened, why that murder rate plummeted in Western Europe over those centuries.
Yes, so Norbert Elias, a German sociologist forced to flee Germany when the Nazis took over, a Jewish academic whose parents died in the concentration camps, and who had the very bad luck of publishing a book called The Civilizing Process in Germany in 1939.
Tough crowd.
Yeah, tough crowd. It kind of seemed like a bad joke. So he was forced to flee. He ended up in England. He was interned in a camp because he was German. And finally, he was let out. He got some jobs.
It's called the double whammy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. From the he was still better off at that internment camp than what the alternative would have been. Yeah. But his theories were only rediscovered in the late 60s. He was still fortunately alive at the time, so that he could comment on them. And he worked from old woodcuts and books of table manners and descriptions, narrative descriptions of what life was like on the ground. It was only later that historical criminologists started digging around in archives and calculating homicide rates, because the records in Europe go back literally 800 years. So they started to plot these homicide rates on a graph over time, 1200 to the present, and what do you know, the rate plummets. Like, goes from close to 100 per 100,000 per year down to 1 per 100,000 per year. And so these quantitative data come out that vindicate his intuitive observation that the Middle Ages in Europe were a more violent place than the present. And so he was the only one who had a theory ready to explain it.
And two theories, in fact, two explanations for that went on at the same time.
Yes, so there was a psychological component to his theory, namely the increase in self-control. We know that everyone has an ability to count to 10 before you explode, to hold your horses, to save for a rainy day, all the things that your mother tells you as you're growing up.
Along with not to put your fork
along with not to push the peas onto the fork. Wait, don't eat until everyone else is seated and served. So all of those forms of self-control, we all have it, but we exercise it to various degrees. And his claim was that there was a increased emphasis on self-control over the centuries. Now, that just begs the question of, well, why did everyone wake up one morning and decide to wait for everyone else to be served and not to respond to insults by stabbing your dinner companion? Why all this self-control? And the first domino in the chain that led to lower violence was the consolidation of kingdoms out of the feudal patchwork of the little principalities and baronies and duchies. They started to get consolidated into territories like France that ruled by a king, and the king started to impose a court system over the country. They not for any benevolent motives, but he would just assume that if someone killed someone else, that the penalty would be you give a lot of money to the king. So mm-hmm. It was a great source of revenue to have this justice over within the borders. But the result was that instead of knights constantly feuding with each other, in fact, today we wouldn't call them knights, we would call them warlords or gang leaders. The whole knight thing was a kind of PR.
Wait, this was chivalry. This is the age of Camelot.
Yeah, and chivalry meant that you could abduct and rape a woman if she belonged to another knight, not if she was unattached. So if you look at what chivalry really
was...
Makes
first dates really important.
Indeed. So the nationalization of criminal justice was one of the first dominoes that got the process going. The other one was an infrastructure of commerce. Money that could be recognized within the borders of the newly consolidated states, better roads, better carts, better clocks, enforceable contracts, all kinds of things that made it cheaper to buy things than to plunder them, and made more and more of the rest of the world valuable to you alive compared to dead. And so if the way to get ahead was not to kill the other knight's peasants and take over his land, but to sell him stuff that you have and buy stuff that he has, it removes the incentives for violence. And these two developments, I think he was quite ahead of his time, because I think that they were two of the major forces that you see throughout history as reducing violence. One of them being a central state where you can outsource your revenge to a disinterested third party instead of getting embroiled in cycles of vendetta like the Corleones. So that's one of the things. And the other is commerce and trade and exchange.
It's interesting you mentioned the Corleones. This is in, of course, the underworld where there is no government to adjudicate disputes. It's by its nature anarchic in that respect, therefore a code of honor. And it brings to mind another of the thinkers, this one better known, about whom you write, and that is Hobbes, who we generally remember for a short, brutish, and nasty.
Yes. Yes, and Hobbes emphasized the necessity of having a, as he put it, a leviathan, which originally meant a sea
monster. He was not in public relations.
He definitely was not. But his idea was that if you surrender the prerogative of violence to one disinterested authority, in his case, most likely a king or absolute ruler, then, for one thing, you would have less incentive to attack your neighbor because the leviathan would penalize you and kind of cancel out anything you hope to gain. But it would have secondary effects. Namely, not only are you disincentivized from attacking your neighbor, but you know your neighbor is disincentivized from attacking you. And that makes everyone calm down because you're not tempted to launch a preemptive strike to do it to him before he does it to you, because the king will do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to maintain a belligerent macho stance to deter your potential adversaries because the king is tougher than you are. So you don't have to have this culture of honor where you respond to insults with violence to prove that you're really tough and firm and resolved enough to defend yourself. So that whole macho culture winds down. And also you don't have each side figuring out who's at fault and who deserves to be punished. And this is, Hobbes anticipated one of the great findings of social psychology, which is that everyone thinks that he is pure as the driven snow, up there with the angels, and that the other guy's violence is unprovoked, raw aggression out of the blue, but you know, my violence is justified retaliation after the fact. Well, you can imagine if you have two sides both thinking that, then you get these blood feuds and Hatfield and McCoy situations. Whereas if you have a disinterested third party who's reckoning and beating out justice, granted, the government is not always totally disinterested, mm-hmm. but still better than each side serving as his own judge, jury, and executioner.
I was fascinated to see this come up in the formulation of court cases. In other words, a murder case, not all that long ago, was between individuals, and it could be settled, as we saw not too long ago in the case of the CIA contractor in Pakistan, with payment of blood money.
Yes, blood money. That's Vergild,
and
man wealth. Yeah.
As opposed to definition of murder as a crime against the state.
Yes, that's right. So when you turn on Law and Order and it's the state of New York versus such and such or the people versus such and such, that actually does indicate a historical change because it used to be more like a lawsuit. The family of the murder victim would demand blood money from the perpetrator or the family of the perpetrator if they've killed the perpetrator. And that's what would even the score. The brilliant idea that some king had was, hey, why should the money go from the family of the murder victim to the family of the perpetrator? And that was really the origin of the court system. Namely, the money goes to the king. As a secondary effect, you now have more or less disinterested third parties deciding justice. Ideally, you've got Justitia, the goddess of justice with the blindfold, the scales, and the sword. And she's the one making the decision instead of the aggrieved victim.
And that brings us to a series of questions that it seems to me involve the United States as both exemplar and outlier, because you notice this plummeting of murder rates in Western Europe. Well, it happens to some degree in the United States too, but only to some degree. The United States does not go down anywhere near as far as Western Europe, nowhere near as far as Canada.
Yes. So among Western democracies, the United States is deeply weird in that it is an exception to many trends that have swept over the rest of the West. The United States, as you mentioned, has a far higher homicide rate. It has come down over the last 20 years, but it used to be that the American murder rate was almost 10 times the rate in many Western European countries. And it's certainly much higher than England and even higher than Canada. The United States is the only Western country that still has capital punishment. The United States is far more willing to go to war than other Western countries like France and Germany, as we recall from 2003. In many Western European countries, corporal punishment in school has been eliminated, and indeed spanking by parents in many Western European countries has been illegalized, and it's considered a human rights violation. The United States, in many of these trends, the interesting thing is that the United States is actually moving in that direction with a bit of a lag. And within the United States, the northern and coastal states are ahead in this trend compared to the southern and southwestern states. And so, kicking and screaming, our country has been pulled in this direction of kind of Scandinaviaization. So Rick Perry and Mitt Romney and so on have a point when they say that that the liberal states are moving in the direction of Scandinavia. But it's kind of, in case after case, it's been an inevitable progression. Another example is slavery. It took our country a lot longer to abolish slavery than most of Europe. But eventually we did it. And with all of these trends, we're behind the curve, but they tend to happen.
And we're behind the trend, but you interestingly put an argument for this code of honor that exists in the United States as an explanation for, we speak just about a month before the great election of 2012, for an explanation of why there are so many deeply red states and so many deeply blue.
Yes, so there is a anthropologists refer to cultures of honor as ones that still have the ethic that a man must defend his reputation with a credible threat of violence. They often trace it to either people who originated in mountainous areas, so not just the mountainous south of the Hatfields and McCoys, but many Southerners trace their ancestry to the Scots-Irish from the hilly parts of Scotland and Northern Ireland. They also trade it to cultures where your wealth is easily stealable, such as livestock. And the world over, livestock herders tend to be tough and mean and macho because they need to, because their wealth has feet and it can be led away in an instant. And it's much easier to rustle someone's livestock than to steal land out from under a farmer. And so cultures of honor often spring up in peoples who live in mountainous areas, who have mobile wealth. And you also mentioned a third contributor to cultures of honor, namely contraband economies. This doesn't apply to the South anymore during Prohibition. But zones where people trade in drugs or diamonds or booze when it's illegal, they feel they've been cheated in a business deal, they can't file a lawsuit. They feel threatened, they can't dial 911. The only way to protect your interests if you're living beyond the reach of the law is with the credible threat of violence. So historians tracing the spread of cultures of honor from the British Isles to America have noted that parts of the country that were settled by Scots-Irish herders and that continue to live beyond the reach of the law, the mountainous south, the Wild West, not only had higher rates of violence, but maintained a culture of honor right up to the present.
Because, in a sense, you pose, the government lacked legitimacy. That centralization of the government, that first part of Elias's theory, that didn't happen.
That's right. The government was slow to extend its reach to many parts of the mountainous south and to the Wild West. You remember the cliche of the cowboy movies. Mm. The nearest sheriff is 120 miles away.
Yeah, only law west of the Pecos.
Yes. So you got to defend yourself with your six-shooter. So a lot of the United States was in a state of anarchy until recently. The closing of the frontier was in the 1890s, and that was more or less the official end of anarchy in the United States. And that was pretty recent. And parts of the country where you did have to defend yourself with your six-shooter wanted to maintain that prerogative even after the government arrived.
And interestingly, you say that in Canada, this did not quite replicate because the Mounties got there before the settlers did.
Yes. So I am Canadian, and so this has special interest to me. But Canada, you look at a map, and it's this massive territory. But if you look at where the people are, they're kind of strung along a little ribbon along the American border, just because it gets too cold if you go any farther north. And Canada was settled east to west along this ribbon, and in many cases, the government and the Mounties got there first. And so there was never a state of anarchy. There was never the same need to develop a culture of honor.
Yet the experiment that you cite is conducted at that great southern University of Michigan.
Yes. Well, and the social psychologist Richard Nisbet deserves credit for exploring the psychology behind cultures of honor, particularly in the contemporary American South.
How this persisted past the closure of the frontier.
Perhaps way past the time when most Southerners were goat herds or shepherds or had livestock. But there was a certain self-perpetuating quality to many cultural traits. And he just compared northern and southern students at the University of Michigan, that is just depending on where they grew up. And he did a number of ingenious provocations. One of them, probably the most famous, was that he had people show up for a bogus experiment. And to get to the lab, they had to squeeze by a research assistant, a stooge hired by the experimenter, who left just a tiny little bit of space. You couldn't avoid brushing by him as he was filing papers. And as he went by, he muttered an obscenity, one that we cannot say on the air. But he compared him to a certain part of our anatomy in the nether regions. And then the subject, having been insulted, his manhood impugned, shows up at the lab, and conveniently, they're taking blood samples for the experiment. They're filming it. And on the way out, they fill out all the biographical information, where you come from, and so on. What they found was that the northern students who'd been insulted kind of laughed it off, like, what's his problem? Mm-hmm. The southern students walked in fuming. They had higher levels of testosterone in their bloodstream, higher levels of cortisone, a stress hormone. They greeted the experimenter with a firmer handshake. And on the way out, they strode more purposefully and forced another research assistant to step aside as they left the lab, compared to the Southerners who had not been insulted, who were perfectly genteel and fine, and the Northerners, whether or not they were insulted.
Three groups, actually. It was the Northerners, the Southerners. The stooge was from Jersey. I say that because I'm from Jersey. This progress, though, this process of civilization, as Elias put it, this is not by any means, and we've made reference to places like Pakistan, a singular arc that continues untrammeled and that happens everywhere at the same time.
No, there's an enormous amount of unevenness in this progression. And parts of the world, it's interesting that you mentioned Pakistan, particularly the Afghan-Pakistan border, which is mountainous, mm-hmm. beyond the reach of the law, and these are many of these people are herders or recently were herders.
So and it has an elaborate code called Pashtunwali.
Yes, a culture of honor, and including the obligation to remember and avenge, to avenge insults, that whole culture. So yes, it's happened unevenly, and many of the developments that I write about in the book happen unevenly, but seem to eventually encompass the world. I mean, a good example is legal slavery, which slavery used to be just part of civilization everywhere.
It's in the Bible.
It's in the Bible. No, Bible had no problem with it. So-called democratic Athens depended on slaves. No, it didn't seem to occur to anyone there might be something a wee bit wrong with slavery. It was really only in the 18th century that the first abolition movements arose, began in Europe, then, of course, many of the Northern American states. We had to have a civil war to get rid of it in the rest. But I have a curve in the book of countries and regions that abolished slavery. And that wave, which began in the 1700s, eventually swept the entire world. And so we're living in an age that, for the first time in history, slavery is not legal anywhere on Earth. Now, there's certainly human trafficking and underground slavery, but the slave auctions, the government returning slaves to their masters, economies that depended on slavery, have gone. Now, just to reinforce how uneven this was, it wasn't until 1962 that Yemen and Saudi Arabia got around to abolishing slavery, and the last holdout was Mauritania, 1980. So, I mean, that is kind of slow. On the other hand, it is now at 100%. And many of the declines are like that. They are uneven, but given enough time, they do seem to spread over the whole world.
Which gets us to really the essence of your argument, that there has been this progression, and if you look at rates of homicide, if you look at rates of death in war, not raw numbers, because on that score, the 20th century had industrialized warfare and produced absolutely horrific numbers.
The first half of the 20th century.
Bloodiest century, in even so, the bloodiest century in recorded history. But if you look at rates of deaths in battle, rates of homicide, there has been a steady progression.
Yeah. Well, if you look at rates as a proportion of the world's population, if there are more people, there are going to be more hotheads, more bloodthirsty despots, more troublemakers, and so everyone has some risk of being a victim of violence. So it is rates that are relevant. If you look at rates, it's not clear that the 20th was the worst. It was pretty bad, but you know, other centuries had their bloodbaths too. The 14th century was a pretty nasty place with Mongol invasions, and every time a dynasty fell in China, you could have tens of millions of deaths. We just aren't taught that in our history classes. But then, after World War II, a funny thing happened, which is that not just the rate, but the absolute number of people dying in war went down, bumpily. I mean, it wasn't a straight line. There were some spikes for Korea and Vietnam and Iran, Iraq. But people haven't noticed this, but for the last couple of decades, the worldwide rate of death in war and numbers, forget even rates, just how many people die in war, is kind of hugging the floor by world standards. We don't notice it because if there's some part of the world that isn't having a war, you don't have a reporter with a camera saying, here I am in Nicaragua, and another year and there's no war.
That's right. You don't make much of a living saying, no news here.
Yeah. So you don't appreciate until you see the numbers. But the post-World War II era has been sometimes called the long peace. Again, it's hard to believe if you remember the particular wars. You got to remember what didn't happen, but which could have happened, and which did happen for centuries before, such as big, powerful, rich countries fighting each other. That was just a constant of history. That's what great powers did. You know, England and Germany, and France and Germany, and Italy and Austria, and name a pair, and you can find a war between them in the history books. As of 1945, European countries, rich countries, powerful countries, stopped fighting each other. A very good thing, because it's the rich countries that can do the most damage when they get into a war. The U.S. and the Soviet Union, every expert predicted that World War III was a certainty, just a matter of time, and that it would be a nuclear war. To everyone's surprise, it didn't happen. There were a lot of nasty proxy wars, colonial wars, wars in the southern hemisphere. But after the end of the Cold War, those started to peter out as well, and the long peace started to spread to the rest of the world.
And immediately people will look up and say, Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, and the massacres at Srebrenica. What's going on today in Syria? The people will say, how can you possibly make this argument that we may be living in the most peaceful era in human existence?
Yes, it's because the rates of violence haven't gone down to zero. And wherever the violence occurs, that's where the news people go. There's always, if it bleeds, it leads. there's always enough violence to fill the news. And so if your impression of how violent the world is comes from the news, you'll think, well, there's just no shortage of violence. It's the same as it ever was. It's only when you remember, first of all the places in the world that are not at war, and you do the comparison of two points in time, which is kind of what a trend is. Mm-hmm. You can't really talk about a trend by looking at what's happening now. Just mathematically, that doesn't make any sense. And it's when you look at the trends and when you look at the data that you see how far we've come. Now, you've mentioned a few wars, but when a curve goes down like that, kind of a declining sawtooth, we remember the spikes, but we forget the lowlands in between the spikes. We also don't mentally compute how many people are killed in each war. Even the horrific wars that we have today, like in Syria, where there's no minimizing the human tragedy there. And you don't want to say, well, you know, it's only 20,000 people. I mean, that's 20,000, you know, men, women, and children. On the other hand, you look at the Iran-Iraq war, that was in the hundreds of thousands. You look at the Vietnam War, that was maybe 2 to 3 million, to say nothing of the world wars. So the wars that do take place are far less destructive of human life than they used to be. Again, something that if you just see something blowing up, you can't appreciate. It's only the nerds who count the bodies that can tell us that that wars are getting less destructive.
And this is not just sort of a rose-colored view of the present, which obviously you acknowledge there's terrible things going on, but it's also important to look at the past with the proper perspective, that it wasn't also great back before the second half of the 20th century. And indeed, back in prehistory, when a lot of people would argue, hunter-gatherer societies were essentially peaceful, warfare was symbolic, not much really happened, and that mankind grew up and developed war as a cultural affectation rather than something that's in our nature.
Yes, there is the what's sometimes called the myth of the noble savage, the romantic idea that people living in as foragers, as hunter-gatherers, as hunter-horticulturalists lived in a state of harmony until the Westerners came. Now, the Westerners undoubtedly did a lot of damage and committed.
Romans have a lot to answer for.
Yeah. Romans have. On the other hand, the rates of death in tribal raiding and feuding were sky high as a percentage of the population. So in many non-Western pre-state societies, you could have death rates of 25%, 30%, 40%, way higher than even in our world wars. So violence has always been a problem. These societies had mechanisms to try to minimize war. They didn't work all that well. They worked sometimes, and with the result that back then the rates were very high.
And there have been people who have observed tribes in places like New Guinea in their warfare and noticed that they would stand about the maximum distance of their projectiles, their bows and arrows for the most part, or spears, launch them at each other. They were largely ineffectual, and that they would then retreat to their various camps, and, well, honor was satisfied. Yet you make an unsettling comparison to our closest primate cousins, the chimpanzees.
Yes. Well, the misleading thing about looking at tribal battles is that, indeed, the battles probably were largely symbolic. The two sides would kind of face each other across a distance. They talk trash at each other, insult each other's mothers, chuck spears that were, you know, usually just missed. And if one was killed, they'd call it a day. The thing is that where they really start to rack up high body counts is not in those spectacles, but in sneaky raids. A bunch of men from one village would surround another village at daybreak when the men would, when the people would get up out of their huts to urinate in the morning. That's when the bows and arrows and the spears and the flaming, the setting huts on fire would begin. So attackers aren't stupid. Why be out in the open and be the target of the other guy's spears if you could surprise them at dawn and kill them before they're organized enough to mount a defense? If you look at the deaths from raids, that's what jacks up the total body count. And so the pitched battles are misleading in that regard.
And indeed, it looks like the chimps do very much the same thing.
And chimpanzees do the same thing. Groups of males will patrol the edge of their border looking for members of some other community. And if they outnumber them by at least 3-1, then they'll tear the other chimp limb from limb. This was a discovery made to her horror by Jane Goodall, and it's been replicated a number of times. So our cousins are pretty nasty, too.
So then there are the questions about the mechanisms by which we have gone from these horrific rates in antiquity. And one of the main questions is it our genes? Are we evolving?
It's not impossible, but I doubt it. I can't rule it out. It's certainly not possible for the changes that we've observed, say, in the last 70 years. So the dramatic decline in war since the end of World War II, it's only two generations, and the Germans went from the world's most warlike people to the world's biggest pacifists in less than two generations. That couldn't have been a genetic change because evolution has a speed limit measured in generations. It's not mathematically impossible that medieval Englishmen were genetically different from modern ones, but given that we can see rates of violence yo-yo up and down over a span of decades, we really don't have to bring in biology to explain change over centuries. We know that some kind of social and cultural mechanisms can change it in that short a time period.
Well, Elias, who we've been talking about, gave us some indications in terms of those mechanisms, Hobbes again with the Leviathan and the power of the state, but there had to be something else going on, and you've come up with, I thought, the most extraordinary idea of what it was, and that in fact it is our consciousness, our ability to reason.
Yes, I think that I tried to identify what went right? What have we been doing right that has driven violence down? And I think that government has been one and commerce has been another. But yet another is reason, thinking, logic. That is, violence is a problem. If you think it through, it can't be a good thing for us to attack each other. I mean, granted, if I attack you and I win every time, it's good for me, but it's really bad for you. And I can't count on that lasting indefinitely. At some point, it's going to be me that's on the receiving end of violence.
Coming out of my tent to urinate in the morning.
Exactly, yes. So when you step back and instead of thinking, you know, God damn it, they killed one of ours, we've got to kill one of theirs, and you think, geez, is there any way to live your life? Then you start to look for ways to reduce violence on both sides simultaneously. And that's the key, because the dilemma is you realize violence is dumb, but you can't be the only guy to beat his swords into plowshares, because if the guy over on the other side of the mountain range still keeps his swords as swords, you know, you can be in trouble. The question is, how do you get both sides to lay down their arms simultaneously? That's a tough problem. No one solved it all at once. But the various individual mechanisms that I explain in the book all fall under the general umbrella of how do you solve the problem of getting everyone to reduce their violence at the same time? Just being a pacifist won't do it. And we come up with strokes of genius or blunder our way through changes in customs, keep the ones that seem to work, like the table manners.
Mm-hmm.
Government, particularly democratic government. I mean, the problem with government is you're basically substituting one kind of violence for another. You're substituting the violence of anarchy for potentially the violence of tyranny, for the Leviathan, the king that's going to threaten all of you.
Right.
The way to get the advantages without the disadvantages is basically democracy. That is, you have a government that is just powerful enough to prevent people from killing each other without doing more damage itself.
So you want a Jefferson rather than a Stalin.
Exactly, and it's not a coincidence that the framers of our Constitution they read their Hobbes, they read their Greek history, their Thucydides, they read their political theory, John Locke, and they actually thought out as an intellectual puzzle. How can we have a government that can justify itself, it's going to be better than anarchy, but that does only what we want a government to do, namely to allow people to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And so, and the whole Constitution was kind of a geeky gadget to try to lay out rules that would reduce violence. Granted, the government's going to have to reserve some violence for itself, but let's keep it as small as possible. The United Nations was another one of those mechanisms. We talked about commerce and trade. After World War II, basically the Europe said, well, hey, let's not do that again. And they tried to think, well, what could make a... we thought we had it figured after World War I, didn't work out so well. Can we do better this time? Just moralistic declarations that war is a bad thing didn't seem to be enough. League of Nations didn't quite do the job. One of the ideas they had is, well, if you have countries like, especially France and Germany, that kept fighting war after war, if they were in a commercial union, particularly for coal and steel, which is the two things you need most to fight a war, and they merged their markets so there was no economic rivalry, maybe then we don't have to be angels, but it'll just be bad business to go to war. And so they set up the European Coal and Steel Union, a number of countries, which then became the European Common Market, which then became the European Union. We've got a lot of tension in the European Union now, but what we don't have is war. So Germany is probably not going to invade Greece. They're going to be sore. They're going to look down on the Greeks, but I don't think we're going to have a shooting war. And that's one of the strokes of genius of the post-war period, was to realize that you have a lot of... there's an old saying, when goods cross borders, armies don't. That's another stroke of genius, so another way we've applied our intelligence to reduce the problem of violence.
I wanted to ask you about another thinker that I had never heard of, and I will mispronounce his name, I am sure. It is Cesare Beccaria.
Oh, yes. He was another hero of this story. He was an Italian economist, today we might call him a sociologist as well, who had the idea that you could control crime without publicly disemboweling criminals or torturing them to death, breaking them on the wheel, pulling them apart by horses, all of the forms of entertainment that they had until the 18th century as a way of punishing criminals. Among other things, he thought, well, it really isn't how gruesome the punishment is that matters. It's the probability of getting caught. Because if you have a horrible form of punishment, and that was the idea at the time, how you deter people, you just make the punishment as gruesome as possible, and that'll scare people straight. The problem is that if it's awful, but it hardly ever happens, you just think, well, it's like an accident. I mean, it'd be really horrible to get into a car accident, too, but it's not going to stop me from driving, because it'll be horrible if it does happen, but it probably won't. Same thing happens with gruesome, unlikely punishment. If you want criminal justice to work, you have it so the punishments aren't that horrible, but they're more likely to happen. Then people think twice before breaking the law. And he had a number of reforms like that where he just kind of figured out if the point of criminal punishment isn't to just satisfy our thirst for blood, to just punish bad people because bad people should be punished, but if we think the point of punishment is to deter crime, how do we rearrange punishments so that we get the most crime reduction for the least amount of pain inflicted?
Sounds like a classic bleeding heart.
Well, he wanted to get tough on crime, just the smartest way possible.
It raises, though, a question, and his views were attacked after he published them, we learned in your book, but very quickly accepted. And these punishments faded very quickly, that things that had happened for millennia as, again, public spectacle. You quote from the diary of Samuel Pepys, who casually mentions going to see a man horribly killed for a crime
at
Charing Cross, and then offering his friends a bowl of oysters on the way home. This sort of thing had gone on forever. How did it stop?
Yes, it's quite a remarkable story in human history. And we sometimes forget because we make jokes about these horrible punishments like the rack. Pepys made a joke about the practice of drawing and quartering, which he had witnessed, which, by the way, consists of partly strangling a person, not letting him lose consciousness. Then you cut him open and take out his internal organs, castrate him, show him the organs while he's still conscious, burn them in front of him before finally strangling him. And the way Pepys described it is not only did he witness this, but he said that when the... And this was actually not some low-life criminal, but a general. He didn't say what the general was, what his infraction was. He said, and the executioner held up his heart, and there were great cries of joy from the crowd. Then we all went out for oysters. another example is crucifixion. There can't be it's hard to think of a ghastlier way to die. But as we remember from the story of Jesus, he was crucified with a couple of thieves. And so it was a common form of punishment during the Roman Empire.
And we remember the end of Spartacus's army, the crosses lined up on the Appian Way.
Yes, exactly. So then, 18th century, everyone thinks the better of it, including our own prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment in the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. That occurred pretty much in the middle of a wave of abolitions of torture of European countries. And at the time, the bleeding heart versus tough on crime debate was, well, if you don't scare people with horrible torture and mutilation, then the crime rate will go through the roof. Why won't people just kill and stab each other? They have nothing to fear. And they were wrong. The homicide rate continued to fall even as the punishments got less gruesome.
Ed, you spoke a lot earlier about the function of reason. You talk about the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment and the importance of those eras. And to some degree, you seem to flinch away from religion. The Protestant Reformation had a great deal to do with both the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment.
Well, religion has a complicated role in this story. The problem with the Protestant Reformation is that it then led to the European Wars of Religion.
It did, but it also led to people being free to have greater ideas, too.
I think it was a product in part of the invention of the printing press, which also later unleashed a flood of ideas. But later, really, it was in the 18th century.
A writer goes for Gutenberg.
Yeah. It was in the 18th century, first of all, that for the first time a majority of people in Western countries could read. It was the age in which books were affordable for the first time. There was a kind of Moore's law of economic efficiency of printing that really only happened in the 18th century. Books started to go viral. They were translated into multiple languages. They were discussed in coffee houses and salons and pubs. And I think that that had a lot to do with these enlightened ideas, including the American Constitution and Bill of Rights. And it was really in the 18th century, I think more than, say, the 16th century, that these truly progressive ideas came about. I mean, the Protestant Reformation also gave birth to a lot of, not just the wars, but burning people at the stake and slaying heretics and persecuting Anabaptists.
Wasn't it that the Vatican was above it?
Oh, no, both sides have a lot to answer for.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting, though, you say at one point that this secular humanism is not necessarily atheistic, but it doesn't seem to be religious either. It does not seem to allow for that. And again, you see the United States as both an exemplar in the Founding Fathers and an outlier in terms of what our society is like today.
Yes, well, the United States is the most religious Western country by far. Another way in which we're not a typical democracy. One of the reasons that the role of religion in the decline of violence is such a complicated story is that religions themselves are moving targets, at least a lot of them are. And religions have gotten far more liberal, progressive, ecumenical than they used to be. You know, most Christians aren't in favor of burning heretics anymore. Whereas it wasn't that long ago that that's what you did, burning witches. Belief in hell has gone down. Religions have gotten more touchy-feely. And I think the same movements that have deglamorized violence across the board have had an effect on religions. We see religions changing. And another example is, say, the Mormon Church, which had a revelation in the 1970s that African Americans did not bear the mark of Cain after all, and that they could serve as ministers in the Mormon Church. That's one of many ways in which religions accommodate themselves to this humanizing tide.
It's interesting, though, in your catalog of the advances against the horrible cruelties of the past and the savage punishments and the you do not mention what a lot of people would talk about today as a Holocaust, and that's abortion.
Well, I do have a section on abortion. Rates of abortion, by the way, have come down all over the world. So it's another, if you consider abortion to be a form of violence, then it's another example of violence being in decline. Needless to say, it is highly controversial whether abortion ought to be considered a form of violence. That's not a debate that I enter into in the book. I have my opinions on it, but that's just not what this book is about. What I do note, though, is that people's perception of abortion is that it is very different from violence against children. Now, the opponents of abortion would say that, you know, what's the difference? It's just an unborn child. And actually made predictions in the late 60s, early 70s, right up through Roe v. Wade, that if abortion were ever decriminalized, then you'd get a slippery slope where later and later fetuses would be aborted, then there'd be infanticide, then there'd be older children, and you'd have just the killing of children. What's not controversial is that that did not happen. There was an increase, a huge increase in the rate of abortion before it then started to decline. But nowhere in the world has infanticide become legalized, and we treat our children more kindly than ever, sometimes to the point of, you know, ridiculousness when you have the helicopter parents hovering over the kids and the lawyers putting
rubber. How would you know anything about that at Harvard? I also wanted to ask you the question that what we have produced through all of these mechanisms that we've talked about, in particular in terms of the commerce and the longer lifespans brought about public health and sanitation, and not to mention the vaccines and advances in medicine, seems to be a population that is unsustainably large, that is engaged in industrial activities which are warming the earth to such an extent that we are going to have Malthusian conflicts over water, over land, because people can no longer live where they used to live and farmed where they used to farm, that this is going to be a future that is going to be unlike the past.
Yes, like the great American Civil War of the 1930s, when because of the Dust Bowl and the Depression and all the Okies moving west, we had a civil war. Now, of course, we didn't have a civil war. There was a lot of misery. There was certainly conflict. There wasn't necessarily war. And the prediction, well, there's going to be resource shortage, therefore there's going to be war, actually has to be given a second thought. And this is not in any way a denial of the seriousness of climate change and global warming. It caused an enormous amount of misery and waste without necessarily causing a war. Because wars, contrary to most people's beliefs, are typically not fought, or at least haven't been for a long time, over resources. They are fought over honor and revenge and fear and ideology. But the thing about resources is they're the one thing that you really can split. You can't split whether Jerusalem is going to be a holy, undivided city for all eternity. That's kind of hard to compromise on. But there's a pool of water, a pool of oil, who gets to use it? You really can divide it up. And statistical studies, as opposed to anecdotes, that try to look at a correlation between resource shortage at time one and war at time two, say in parts of Africa that have had drought and so on, find little to no correlation.
And I want to bring us back to where we started. Your mom obviously went to the same mom school that mine did. Her answer as to why you can't put your peas on your fork with your knife was, because I said so. But that is another factor through all of this that you write consistently through the book, and that is the civilizing impact of women.
Yes, so I think that feminization is another of the major forces that have contributed to declines of violence in a number of ways. For one thing, violence is kind of a guy thing. You look at any statistic on violence, homicides committed, assaults, violent fantasies, play fighting in kids. Every time it's the male gender that is responsible for the lion's share of the violence. In a world in which women are more empowered, glory, honor, grandeur, conquest just aren't as sexy to women as they are to men, on average. I mean, there are exceptions. Mm. So that's one factor. The other factor is when women are empowered, in particularly when they have control over their own reproduction, which is often the most heavily contested battleground in the war between the sexes and the empowerment of women, they don't have as many babies. They get married later. They have their first child later. They stop having children sooner. And so you don't have these youth bulges where you have enormous numbers of young people with nothing to do except get into trouble. And parts of the world that have, in which women have access to contraception, abortion, marriages are arranged by the bride and groom as opposed to the parents and grandparents. Women are not betrothed in their teens. Those parts have lower birth rates and tend to have lower rates of violence.
I was fascinated to read the description that the greatest factor that changed the very high rates of violence in the old American West, the Wild West, was not the arrival of the sodbusters or indeed the flinty-eyed marshal, but the schoolmarm.
Yes. Well, yes, there's another cliche of the old cowboy movies that has some element of truth, that when the West was a largely male enclave, you had men who would, just like in the cowboy movies, they'd go to the saloons, they would get drunk, one would insult the other, there'd be furniture flying, gunshots, and bodies on the floor. The women would largely be prostitutes, and so the life was basically whoring and gambling and boozing. Then
there was a little hard work involved in there too, but yeah.
During the day, and then then the in a second wave, more and more women moved out west. There were spinsters and widows, and the gender imbalance was
Civil
addressed.
War helped with that. Yeah.
Civil War helped with that. Yeah, nature abhors a lopsided sex ratio, and so women's. And as they moved west, they did not put up with this whoring, gambling, boozing lifestyle, and they started to impose what we call family values, with the help of the church, with the ministers, and they kind of shut down the brothels and had the men dress up and go to church on Sunday morning and tried to make it a little more family friendly, because there's nothing in it for them, life of whoring and boozing. And so the women really were, it sounds kind of corny and old fashioned, but in a very real sense, women were a civilizing force in the American West.
Steven Pinker, I can't imagine that anybody's going to not have some arguments with you, but I can't also imagine that anybody doesn't wish that you're really right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Steven Pinker is ready to take your question. So put a hand up if you would like to ask a question, and the gentleman in the blue shirt right there.
Hi. You mentioned chimpanzees briefly during your discussion, and one of the things that I've sort of been interested in is reading about the difference between what they call regular chimps and bonobos. And there's a lot of conflicting information out there. Some people say that, bonobos, they're they're all lovey-dovey, and then there's primatologists who say that that's just hippie nonsense. And so, I mean, do you have an opinion on where the truth lies?
Yeah, and I do write about bonobos in Better Angels. There's no doubt that bonobos are less nasty than common chimpanzees. These are two sister species. They're more closely related to each other than they are to us. We're equally related to bonobos and chimps. And so it's true that you can't, given that there is a difference between them, not that bonobos are nonviolent, they do attack each other, but what they don't have is the groups of males patrolling borders and murdering males from other communities as a systematic practice. So if you were just to look at chimps and bonobos, you couldn't say that proves that we're similar to chimps, because we're no more closely related to chimps than we are to bonobos. My understanding of primate evolution, though, is that the common ancestor of humans, chimps, and bonobos is far more likely to resemble a chimp than a bonobo. That is, the bonobos are the outlier. They kind of evolved in an unusually peaceful direction compared to all the other great apes. So if you were to say, who are we more similar to, the answer is probably the chimps.
Next question. We've got a person right there. Yes.
Thanks very much. It was a really fascinating talk. The question I have is, I understand the long view where we have a decrease in mortality, but the wars that we seem to have had in the last, really since Vietnam, and maybe even including Vietnam, may not have had the number of fatalities that were in previous war, but we seem to have a huge number of people that are wounded, if not mortally wounded. They're seriously wounded. So have we replaced the violence of simply counting up the dead with looking, you know, with wars in which people really become maimed and less productive?
Yes, well, because of advances in medical technology, we certainly can save some wounded soldiers who would have been goners in earlier wars. On the other hand, weaponry has also increased. That's the problem with technological changes. It gives with one hand and takes with another. On the whole, though, it's probably true that the life-saving technology has advanced more than at least the deployment of life-taking technologies. So that has some effect, but it's certainly not the case that, say, that there's, you know, you could imagine that the same number of people get shot in all wars, but we just get better and better in saving them, and the proportion who die, therefore, goes down, and so we have the illusion that there's less violence. That is most definitely not true. You just have to do the math. If there are, say, 58,000 Americans who died in Vietnam, and the medical technology got, say, even 50% more effective, that still doesn't give you the same ratio with only 5,000 to 6,000 killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. To say nothing of the several hundred thousand Americans that were killed in World War II. Things that variation in wars, of dead and wounded, go by orders of magnitude. You can have 1,000 times more people killed in one war than in another war, whereas improvements in medical technology can only affect the percentages. You have 1,000 times more people who are wounded, it almost doesn't matter how much better your medical technology is, you're still going to have more dead and more wounded.
Yes, right here down front.
Well, thank you for a very eloquent discussion about a very complex issue. My question is whether you have a predictive theory going forward to get violence to nothing, something societal or cultural or raising the consciousness. Of course, besides requiring all world leaders to be women.
Yeah. I think that one has to be cautious about about prognosticating. As Yogi Berra said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. I think there are some things that there are some kinds of violence that I don't think will ever fall to zero. I think there'll always be some drunk young man who loses his temper in a bar and strangles someone who insults him. There'll always be a lady somewhere puts arsenic in her husband's tea. You know, I really do believe in human nature. I believe that human nature has a lot of nasty bits to it that are not going to go away. On the other hand, something can stay above zero but still be a lot less than what it is today. And I think certain categories of violence are very likely to go down and certainly unlikely to go back up. I think wars between developed countries are very unlikely to recur. There will still be civil wars, but even there, I think we'll see fewer of them as the world becomes more democratic, as the world becomes more interconnected, and as the whole idea of war becomes less glamorous. I think that violence against women will decrease worldwide because it seems to be a campaign, a worldwide moralistic campaign that proceeds often slowly, often unevenly, but I think inexorably. So just as it took a while for the last bits of legal slavery to be abolished, it took a while before whaling was abolished and piracy and atmospheric nuclear testing. When you've got all of the official bodies of the world directed against a practice, history shows that it will go down. I think terrorism will, there anything can happen. We've got a world of 7 billion people. There's no shortage of grievances. There's no shortage of hotheads. And who's to say that you're not going to have one guy or one group of six guys somewhere among the 6 billion people who isn't going to set off a bomb somewhere. On the other hand, terrorism as a major force for change is unlikely to grow simply because it's been proven to be so futile. Terrorists almost never get what they want. What are some of the other categories? Homicide is harder to predict because we have seen some yo-yoings in the rate. They sometimes go up, sometimes go down. I don't think they're going to go back up to rates that we saw in the Wild West or the Middle Ages. They might go up or down a little bit, but people are not going to tolerate that kind of violence, and I predict that the trend will still be with bumps downward. So those are a few of the predictions that I am and am not willing to make.
Right there. Thank you.
Do you think you could speak about the arc of interest that traces from how the mind works to the language as reflection of the mind to trends in human violence?
Sure. The common thread is an interest in human nature. And if you're interested in human nature, you can't avoid the question of, are we violent by nature? Are we peaceful by nature? You know, are we like the chimps? Are we like the bonobos? Are we noble savages? Are we, you know, nasty, brutish, and short? This debate goes back literally hundreds of years, and anyone who's just interested in how the mind works has to think about them. In the book, my book with the title, How the Mind Works, I actually foreshadowed some of the themes of this book because I noted a few factoids that I was aware of then that I brought up for a specific reason, and that is among enlightened progressive people, there is a resistance to the idea of human nature. I wrote a book about that resistance called The Blank Slate, about the politics and emotions that surround the concept of human nature, where many progressive people are uncomfortable with the very idea because they think, well, if people are just nasty to the core, then why try to make the world a better place? People will just screw it up no matter what you do. We just got to live with violence and sexism and other forms of nastiness and exploitation. Therefore, it would be much nicer if we were to believe that the mind is a blank slate and that parents and society and culture can just write whatever they want on the slate of the newborn child. I think this is illogical for a number of reasons. One of them is that even if we do have nasty motives, the mind is a very complicated system, and we also have systems of the brain that can inhibit violence, like self-control, like empathy. And it's what kind of violence actually emerges depends on which of these parts of our nature gets the upper hand. So that was the argument, and I mentioned, and I said, not only can some parts of human nature suppress the more violent parts, but clearly it's happened. For example, we abolished slavery. For example, rates of violence in modern societies are lower than those of tribal peoples. For example, homicide declined since the Middle Ages. So we see with our own eyes, not only can human nature allow for declines of violence, but we've seen it happen. So I had a couple of paragraphs in How the Mind Works. I had a couple of paragraphs, well, actually really a chapter on violence in the blank slate. Then the turning point was when I was asked to contribute an answer to the question, what are you optimistic about, for an online forum, edge.org. And so I reiterated these paragraphs that were mildly optimistic from those two prior books. It got enough attention that scholars in fields that I was barely aware of wrote to me and they said, well, you could have expanded your list of historical declines of violence. For example, it wasn't just England that saw a decline of homicide since the Middle Ages. It was also Germany and Italy and Scandinavia. It wasn't just that that there hasn't been a major war since World War II involving all of the world's powers, but even in poorer parts of the world with smaller countries, the rate of war has gone down. Someone else wrote to me and they said, well, did you know that rates of domestic violence are down, rates of child abuse are down, rates of kids picking on each other with violence are down? And it started to look like a conspiracy. Like, all of these scholars writing to me, sending me their data, you know, down, down, down. And no one seemed to know about it. Everyone thinks that the world's getting more violent. And here I was sitting on all of these reports from these different branches of academia, all of them showing violence going down. So I thought, someone has to tell the story, and someone should take some crack at explaining it. And that was the origin of what became the Better Angels of Our Nature. A title which, by the way, from Abraham Lincoln, but which explicitly refers to the components of human nature that work to reduce violence, that combat our inner demons, as I call them.
Another question?
Hi. I heard for the first time today the million-dollar blocks in New York. Are you familiar with these? I'm sure you are.
Million-dollar block?
Blocks in the Bronx in New York. That their research has been done that a significant portion of men in prison all came from the same blocks in New York because of the community. And they so there has been research done on this, and then I think they did it about 15 years ago. And it's the first time I had heard it, obviously. Yes. Anyhow, the point being that it was where the... in the slums and in certain communities, more violence then took place, and more men went to prison there than in other areas of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. No? Or New York, yeah, this was the Bronx.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard of that particular finding.
Brooklyn, too, there's a block.
Okay. I hadn't read that particular article, but it doesn't surprise me in that there are... there's a lot of unevenness in urban crime. Some neighborhoods, some blocks are more violent than others, partly because they may be out of sight of the police, partly because feuds and gang wars can start on contested turfs and memories are long and you get revenge and retaliation and Hatfield-McCoy type of stuff that's localized. One of the declines of violence that did not come up in our conversation this evening so far was the great American crime decline, the fact that the homicide rate in the United States has fallen by more than half since 1992, and has fallen most dramatically in New York. New York used to be one of the most dangerous cities, now it's one of the safest cities. There's controversy over what, among all the things that New York did that was successful in driving down crime, but one of them was the meticulous gathering of block-by-block data on where the violence was occurring, a system called CompStat. And at weekly meetings, precinct captains would have their feet held to the fire if their particular neighborhood was one where violence was high or trending upwards. And by concentrating resources on the worst areas, then the overall crime rate can be brought down. So the finding that you mentioned isn't surprising to me.
Another question. We have one at the very back row, right back there.
Yeah, thank you. And do you hold out any hope that the National Rifle Association will ever give up control of Congress?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but I will. I love to collect statistics on declines in various aspects of violence. Here's one, and this one people find almost unbelievable, but there are two different data sets that show it. That proportion of American homes with guns has been in steady decline. It seems hard to square that with the fact that, you know, guns keep getting manufactured and sold, and, you know, old ones presumably don't rust out as quickly as new ones are produced. And probably what's happening is that there are some people who have lots of guns that collect them and for various reasons. But overall, our gun culture, another way, by the way, in which the United States is highly unusual compared to other Western democracies, but nonetheless, the trend by household has been downward. And likewise, by the way, hunting has gone down. Hunters are getting older and older. Young people don't find it so cool to go out and kill animals for fun, with the exception of a few locavores. Those are two trends in which, despite all of the controversy over gun control and NRA and so on, American gun culture actually appears to be in decline.
And I think we had another one at the second to last row, right back there. Yes.
Two quick questions. One is, I'm wondering if the distance of time since the Second War, it's about 70 years from now, is that enough time to project how the casualty rates in war, does that work mathematically to make that assumption? And the other thing is, civilizing influence is taught at the hands of your mom at the dinner table, and families aren't eating dinner together anymore so much, yeah. What does this spell for the future of our society? Yeah.
Well, one could imagine that the 67 years since World War II, maybe just a lucky streak, and our luck is about to run out. I actually did a calculation in the book, and I think we can say with very high degree of mathematical certainty that that's not true. That is, there hasn't been a constant rate, and we're at the end of a gambler's lucky streak. The astronomically unlikely that the rate has been the same. That's one possibility. An even worse possibility is that some people wonder whether the tendency toward war is cyclical. That is, there's a release, the tension builds up, the whole system blows up, and so if it hasn't happened for a while, well, it's going to get more and more likely with each passing year. And that, too, is not true. Mathematically, there's no real cyclicity to war, and war is not like, it's not a hydraulic urge like thirst or sleep or sex, where the longer you do without it, the more you want it. That's not the way violence works. As John Mueller pointed out, if that were true, then countries like Holland would just be roaring for a fight. but they don't seem to be. The other is about families eating together. When people think of socialization and culture, they tend to think of families. And a theme that I explored in my book, The Blank Slate, is that it's important not to confuse culture with parents. We tend to blend them, to blur them together. But probably when it comes to the socialization of children, parents are overrated. This is an argument that I adapted from Judith Rich Harris in her book, The Nurture Assumption. But culture can matter even if it isn't inculcated by parents. And what's probably more important is the peer culture that you're immersed with and norms that hold in your society that even if you're brought up in a by weird parents in a dysfunctional family, you absorb these larger societal norms anyway. So I don't think that the less time spent around the dinner table will reverse the trend toward greater civility.